Okay, so we're going to start this morning with new matters, paper 2 on IFRS 15. And it's Cam's first time presenting to the Interpretations Committee, so normal rules apply. For new committee members, that means you need to be nice. Doesn't mean you have to agree, but you have to be nice to Ken today. Doesn't mean you can be horrible to the other staff. Particularly nice to Ken. So handing over to Ken.
We will start with agenda paper 2. The committee received a request asking whether training costs to fulfill a contract with a customer meet the criteria in IFRS 15 for an entity to recognize those costs as an asset. Paragraph 5 outlines the fact pattern described in the request. We conducted outreach on this matter, summarized in paragraphs 11 to 15. Paragraphs 16 to 36 present our analysis of how an entity accounts for the training cost to fulfill the contract in this particular fact pattern. And our conclusion is summarized in paragraph 37 of the paper. In our view, in the fact pattern described in the submission, the entity applies IAS 38 and recognizes the training cost as an expense when incurred. Question 1 on page 9 of the paper asks whether you agree with our analysis of the requirements in IFRS standards.
Okay, who wants to talk about IFRS 15?
Start it off. I agree with the result the staff gets to. But I think I go down a different path. It seems to me there's a bit of a circularity in the standards where IFRS 9 refers to, unless it's in another standard, you apply paragraph 95, and then 38 says, unless it's in another standard, you apply 38. I've always kind of looked at 38 as the backstop. It's the, hey, this applies if nothing else applies. So I personally have started with IFRS 15, go down to paragraph 95. I agree with the and luckily the two, they reach the same conclusion. And so I get to the same conclusion, I think, as the staff, but I've gone down a different path.
Okay, thank you. Young Su?
I just want to be kind to Ken. You know, I agree with the staff analysis and conclusion. I also agree with Bob that there's kind of circularity in the standards, but no matter what standard we apply, 38 or 15, we get to the same conclusion. So I agree with the staff conclusion.
Okay. Mikhail?
My understanding is that we are having different periods when we have the training cost and then when we later will be compensated for the training cost. And for me, I think we should have the matching principles, and I don't think that, or I see that there are some people here arguing for this paragraph 97, where this is explicitly stated, and that if you have chargeable costs, it could be part of this asset. So I don't see that the staff has elaborated around the paragraph 97, as is also mentioned in the document.
Bertrand?
I agree with the staff analysis and conclusion, and I acknowledge the fact that, as others mentioned, there is a tension between IFRS 15 and IAS 38. So even though I don't disagree with the conclusions, I heard negative feedback from France, in France, actually, and it made me think of, again, to the issue. And I think there is a problem with paragraph 67 in IAS 38. So once again, there is a problem with IAS 38. I think this is a rule-based paragraph plugged into a principle-based standards, and principle-based standards, let's put it that way. You have a kind of universal conclusion that all such examples of costs are to be accounted for expense as incurred. That is for training costs, but that is also for advertising, marketing, and promotion costs. We have an issue there in the film industry, notably, whereby those costs can be capitalized into the cost of the film, even though they participate in the creation of the exclusivity of the IP within the film. And so I got sympathy for those who effectively did capitalize such training costs in the circumstances described in the specific request submission. Sorry, it means what I'm just meaning is that instead of having a universal rule expressed in paragraph 67 of IS 38, you could have a more principle-based insight into this this paragraph, saying that effectively, in most instances, you don't capitalize, you can't capitalize, except in specific circumstances. And it's what annoys me a bit is that effectively we just apply universally a conclusion to any circumstances just because there is a specific sentence in a standard applying to a nature of expense. I mean, our P&L is presented by function, not by nature, for instance. If I retain again the example of Vivendi, and if I put more insight into not just those this specific submission, but rather a more global fact patterns. And so we could do it differently, because I'm not sure that in this specific fact pattern that the submission describes, the outcome, even though I totally agree with the conclusion, it's not the problem, but I'm not sure the outcome is the proper one and is the most relevant one in the circumstances of the submission. And then if you would like another outcome there, you need some form of standard setting to amend paragraph 67, because I think the problem is in paragraph 67.
Okay, so can I break your response into two parts, if I could? So are you saying that you agree with the staff analysis of the words?
Yes.
And as a second point, you're saying it might be good if the outcome were different, but you're acknowledging we'd need to be standard setting for people?
Yes.
Okay, thank
you. Correct.
Bruce.
And it's more generally for the rule of 67, not just for those training costs.
Bruce?
Thanks. Thank you. I actually agree with the staff's analysis, and I actually agreed with the way they got there. I mean, I've always looked at this quite simply. I mean, I think maybe I see where you're going with Bertrand's answer, and that there's two different things here. The one is, in the question we've been asked, I think the stands tell us exactly what to do, and I think the staff has captured that in terms of what we've said. So I was comfortable with that. I mean, I think the second issue of are we uncomfortable with the way the standard's currently written? Yeah, look, we've got a few challenges and things on some of those issues. I mean, especially that definition of training costs. I mean, you know, you can drive a bus through it at the moment in terms of what is actually a training cost. But I don't think we're going to solve that in the short term in terms of this. So I agreed with what the staff have come up with.
Thanks, Bruce. Guy.
I also agree with the answer in the tentative agenda decision. I guess maybe a few observations on some of the comments that were made. You know, I think the circularity point around, you know, one standard says if it's in scope of another, as does the other says if it's in scope of the other, it does seem a bit circular. But, you know, I thought the emphasis in the staff paper around, well, no matter what, it has to meet the definition of an asset, was quite helpful to resolve some of that circularity. You know, I was thinking in the context of the costs under IFRS 15, is there any way to argue that there is an asset there because of the rechargeable nature of the cost? And I was thinking the way I would have thought about that is I'd first determine, you know, do I have a contract asset because it's contributing to performance? If the answer to that is no, do I have an unconditional right to payment once I've incurred those, and do I have a receivable? If the answer to that is no, then I need to assess, well, do I have an asset for the cost to fulfill? And there I would have thought no, for the reasons expressed in the paper regarding my ability to control the trained employees, et cetera. So I thought the point in the paper about, well, remember, it's got to meet the definition of an asset regardless, was helpful in addressing that that circularity. I guess the other observation, maybe similar to Bertrand's point on training costs, you know, I think there's maybe some you know, room for judgment around what constitutes a training cost. And that is perhaps beyond the scope of the analysis in the agenda decision. We have a submission that said we incurred training costs. But I was wondering there if, rather than delving into, what was the true underlying nature of those costs? Are they really training in nature? I think the way I would have read the submission is, the submitter has determined that, if they had to apply IS 38 to those costs, those do meet the definition of training costs and would have to be expensed under 38. But I think in reality, there's probably some judgment in identifying what are training costs and are they the types of costs that are contemplated in 38. So I was also pausing and wondering if there was a way of sort of excluding that assessment from the agenda decision by just saying, they were otherwise determined to be training costs as contemplated in 38.
Okay. Custom. Don't touch the buttons. I should have told you guys that. You're always live, so don't whisper either. Unless you're happy for your whispers to be webcast.
Right. So I think similar to others, I was also wondering a bit about the circularity issue, but I think that's probably sufficiently addressed in the staff paper, especially with the reference to paragraph 5 in IS 38, which makes it quite clear that training costs are in the scope of IS 38. I wasn't entirely sure about the part where the analysis talks about if we were in IFRS 15 and what the conclusions might be, but I think it's probably not relevant to the conclusion if we say IS 38 or other standards are the applicable standard. One other point I'd like to make, picking up on what I think Guy said, is about the asset and whether an asset exists. I think the fact pattern seems to assume that the right to reimbursement is conditional upon the delivery of future services, in which case I would agree that there isn't an asset until those services has been delivered. I just thought the fact pattern wasn't entirely clear in that regard, whether it's conditioned upon future services, because IFRS 15 paragraph 95 just says you look at other standards first. So if there was an unconditional right to payment, irrespective of the delivery of future services, I think you would look at IFRS 9 and whether you have a receivable at that point in time. So I think it might just be helpful to clarify that in this fact pattern, the right to payment is conditional upon the delivery of future services, which I think is what the paper probably assumes.
Although that wouldn't matter if you were strictly in 38, would it? Because it gives you the black and white answer.
It just says you look at other standards first, so that might be IFRS 9 as well. That was my thought.
Brian?
So like others, I agree that I think these costs should be expensed as incurred. I think that's true under 38. I also think it's true under IFRS 15. Scope is quite tricky in this area, as some people have mentioned. So given that, to me at least, scope doesn't matter in this particular case, I would actually leave the scope question until the time when scope does matter. I would just say I would expense these costs in either case. As to what these costs are, I think that's an interesting question. My feeling in this kind of fact pattern is that the dominant element in the training cost will typically be the cost of training actual individuals. It's the cost of their time, of the building, of the instructor's time, that kind of thing. And it's because the dominant thing in these training costs relates to the workforce, that at least in my mind, it's so clear that even if you were in 15, you would still expense them because you can't control your employees. I guess my last point is I am pleased that a couple of people have mentioned reimbursement. When I've had this question in practice, we've had this discussion about do you have an asset under 38 or 15, and then we've had a slightly separate discussion about whether or not reimbursement matters. I guess my take is that an unconditional right to reimbursement might tell me something about the transaction price. It might tell me something about whether or not I have a receivable, but I don't think it affects the accounting for the underlying costs. I think that reimbursement entry, that receivable entry, is different to my cost accounting entry. So I would expense. I think training costs are mainly about people. And it would actually be quite helpful, I think, to flag up the reimbursement point.
Jim?
I agree with this staff analysis and the conclusion. And thinking about the circularity and the guy and other mentioned, yeah, I think good thing is with the training issues, it's quite clear that after reading through this analysis, we can end up with the right standard should apply to this case. And I also felt a little bit about the old principle of being prudent accounting. And I think nowadays people tend to overcapitalize some expenses that historically has been expensed, like this kind of training or some other activities that if you think long and hard toward revenue matching, you could link it to the future benefit a little bit, but the bottom line is the solid asset accounting, and I don't think we should promote the over-capitalizing feeling toward the field so that our accounting practices should be still solid and at least toward a more prudent way, not the aggressive over capitalizing direction. Just a thought.
Okay, thank you. Lisa?
And from my perspective, I agree with the staff's analysis based on what's actually written in the standard, except when it comes to the scope aspect. I do think that it is confusing and a bit circularity and differences in how people can interpret that when they see how IS 38 says that if you're within IFRS 15, then you look to IFRS 15. So I think that there's something there that should be looked into. I actually have a different view in regards to these costs, that I feel that if any costs are direct and incremental to a contract that is within the scope of IFRS 15, then I think that you should be looking to the criteria. And if you meet paragraphs 95 to 98 in IFRS 15, then you should be able to capitalize those costs and recognize it in accordance with kind of more the matching principle with the revenue within the contract. However, the fact pattern in this particular situation, kind of like Carson said, it was difficult to know is, you know, are these costs refundable even if the services aren't provided, or do the services have to be provided in order to recover the cost? That was a bit unclear, and I think some of that information is quite important in actually going through this analysis. But I know the one bit, I know in the conceptual framework it talks about having an asset and being able to control it. One of the things I questioned was that, well, you know, what is your asset? If you are in 15 and you're looking at a reimbursement, is the asset really a receivable versus actually the training cost? And therefore, because it's a receivable, can you actually meet that control aspect? So that was some of the thought process that I went through there.
Carl.
Thank you. Very similar thoughts to Brian's. And I'm comfortable with the proposed tentative agenda decision, and I am also comfortable with the current wording of the standards. I don't have any concern regarding that, with the due respect to my colleagues.
Okay, thanks, Carl. Gora?
Yes, thank you.
I basically agree with the staff recommendation. Analysis and recommendation, and it appears that majority of preparers would account for similar transaction as expense, while there seems to be quite a few would account for it, recognize intangible assets. And I would welcome if the agenda decision will help to reduce the diversity in practice. Having this might be a quite naive comment because I'm not technical, and I'm that representing users. I think that the staff emphasizes a lack of control of employees by entity A too much. Probably this is because IS 38. I think entity A may not have sufficient control of the individual employees, but may have a team of skilled employees as a whole. And entity A may lose some employees after the training, but as far as the team of the trained employees can provide the service to customers of entity B, I think entity A does control of the active control over the expected future economic benefits. So I believe that is how exactly how entity A manages that, manages and does its business. Therefore, I doubt if the IAS 38 could be naturally applied to this fact pattern in the submission. So I would say that there should be at least a room for judgment if the, this training cost is actually be expensed or not. But basically, I'm okay with that, the analysis and conclusion.
Before I let you in, Mary, I'm going to, well, I'm going to give you a prompt, but I'll wait and give you my prompt later. Bonnie? You don't want to be prompted?
Thank you, Sue. I do agree with the staff conclusion. I guess just the comment on the circularity of the standards, I had the same, and I got some feedback around the same point. And I just, because it's quite prevalent, I just wonder if a tentative agenda decision is the right place to deal with that potential circularity. Perhaps it is, but I just wonder if there's so many people that see the same point, if there isn't something more to be done rather than just an agenda decision.
Thank you, Bonnie. Which is a useful precursor to my prompt. You might not
that want was not
to
planned.
Sorry, but this is sort of directed at you and the staff, looking at Henry in particular, given his background. I guess it depends, obviously, what the committee thinks, but just a couple of observations. I think if we were able to say something on scope, it would make the agenda decision a more helpful agenda decision, because it wouldn't then just be about training costs, but that's just a wish, as opposed, and we can come back to that. Secondly, a few people have made comments about receivables and the ability to recognise assets. And I think when I read the paper, my sense was that we were talking about a different asset, which was really whether we could recognise an asset for the enhancement of the value of our staff, if you like. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if anybody had any comments to make on that, just to see if that helps or hinders the discussion. And with that, Mary, no pressure.
Well, I don't know if you want to invite comments on that second point, because mine kind of goes back to the scope.
Well, do you want to talk about the scope first?
Okay. Well, because I was going to say on the, as I listened to the discussion and think about the significance of this agenda decision, to me it's actually maybe less about the specific point of training costs and perhaps more about the scope. I know Bob talked about in his comments to kick off the discussion, talked about the circularity and how you viewed IAS 38 as the backstop, so you only get to 38. And then you went on to say it doesn't matter in this case because the outcome is the same. But when I look at in the paper, paragraph 28, I thought the staff had done a nice job of kind of resolving the circularity issue, which I think is a valid concern to have come to the interpretation committee, because I think the paragraph 28 in this paper makes clear that IFRS 15 makes clear that 38 trumps in this case. And that's important both for 38 specifically and I think more generally for the interaction of other standards with IFRS 15. And to me that was the more important point out of this issue, where training costs is just kind of the example. The other point, and it goes to something that both Bonnie and Brian raised, I think there's a separate question about when do you recognize the receivable for the right to recharge, but I think that that's a separate and potentially almost distracting question, because that's about the recognition of a different asset, which is the right to receive that amount. It's not about incurring the training costs. And I think the tension that people may be feeling, I'm now getting into psychological analysis, goes back to Bertrand's point, which people may be frustrated with 38 and maybe be looking to push the boundaries a bit on something like this. But I think Bertrand's comment about if you want to change that, you need to do standard setting, and that's a 38 issue. It's not a 15 issue, that we would help people sort out problems by separating out those strands of thought.
anybody wants to comment on that, I think it would be helpful, because I was also very convinced by paragraph 28 in the paper. So I'm wondering whether, because the answer's the same, it's making us focus less on that paragraph than we might otherwise. But I'd be interested in some additional thoughts on that, because for me, I think this question and this agenda decision felt much more about the scope than about training costs when I first read it. And I think we're tipping the conversation the other way. And if that's what we have to do, that's fine. But I'd like to just explore the scope a little bit more if we could. Bonnie?
I put my thing up in response to the question that you had asked about kind of the second part, not the scope part. And the one question that I had in my mind, and I didn't resolve, but I think it goes to the point of workforce isn't an asset, but there are potentially certain payments and maybe not training costs, but things where you could make an argument that there is. And I'm thinking in my mind about unions and costs that are paid as part of union negotiation contracts and other things. Now, not training costs, but I do think that the scope question potentially is here, and maybe that's a little easier to deal with than the other question to deal with a little bit of IS-38, because I agree with some of the things that Bruce and some of the others have said about IS-38.
Thank you. Bob?
On the scope question, I think, yes, I've read paragraph 28, but I think there's equally as strong arguments for looking at it the other way. The part that bothers me is that 38 seems to be very, just a blunt instrument. Just training costs are not an asset. And if I give you a different fact pattern, if I was to develop training materials, it's part of the performance obligation. So my performance obligation, my contract is I will provide you with some type of equipment and I will train your employees to do that. And in order to do that, I need to incur some costs, training costs. I'm troubled by, and I know Henry wants to jump in on this, but I'm troubled by, you know, somebody just automatically going to 38 and say, oh, training costs, I got to expense it, when I think that really they should be going through the paragraph 95 in IFRS 15 thought process there, and they might have a case for then considering those as fulfillment costs that should be capitalized.
Mary's twitching.
I am, because I think you created a very different scenario when you started out by saying, you identified delivery of training as a performance obligation, because I think when we're looking at the scope question and the applicability of paragraph 94 in IFRS 15, paragraph 94-95, that's a discussion in the context of, and I'm looking at Henry to see if I'm getting this right,
But if I never get past the first sentence of paragraph 95, because I go, oh, it's part of 38, and I never get to A, B, and C, because I got to go jump to 38 until you say, okay, 38 says I got to expense it, I think I've gone down the wrong path.
But wouldn't the volume wouldn't up.
Well, I think Bob doesn't this touch a little bit what Guy was saying earlier on about your judgment about what the training costs in IS-38 is. So, in the example here, we're talking about very clearly about the training of the entity's employees, which is what that language in paragraph 15 is. Paragraph 22 of the paper is talking about there. You're talking more about effectively, I think, costs that might well qualify under paragraph 95 of IFRS 15, because these are other resources that you're creating that will either be used to fulfil the performance obligation or will actually transfer to the customer under that contract. So I think, you know, picking up Guy's point, I think you've got to be careful about training and not just sort of view that very broadly. I think you have to analyse exactly what costs you're talking about. But I think there's a distinction in your example between the two. And I just sort of what Mary said about the scope earlier on. I mean, the other paragraph I draw attention to in the paper, I can't find it now, but there's the bit in the basis for conclusions to IFRS 15 that supports
the paragraph, the quote from that's in paragraph 28 of the paper that's just really re-emphasising that point about you look to the other standards first before you apply paragraph 95. So paragraph 95 in IFRS 15 is essentially the residual. And I think there kind of had to be that little bit of that scope point in IAS 38, because otherwise you'd get the problem about, well, you know, contract assets could potentially fall into IAS 38. You'd also get questions about, well, if I capitalise an asset under paragraph 95, am I meant to then do the subsequent accounting under IAS 38? So I think that was more the thinking about what that scope exclusion was trying to do. But I mean, I appreciate the comments about, you know, there is a little bit of a tension there in the circularity, but I see the sort of the clarity of IFRS 15 as, and backed up by the basis, as sort of saying very much look to other standards first, and whether they explicitly tell you what to do with these costs, account from them there, and come to IFRS 15 as a residual when you haven't got guidance elsewhere.
Jay?
Thank you. I think to the question of scope, I actually thought the paper dealt quite nicely with the question of scope, but I think this discussion is bringing out actually some of the judgment and the things that you need to think about. I mean, to Mary's point, the question of whether actually there's a performance obligation in there associated with training the customer's employees, or perhaps, as I think, Brian, you articulated, the sort of looking at the nature of the costs and saying, is this about creating a workforce or a better informed workforce? And therefore, I think I'm happy, as I say, with the scope, but what this discussion is doing is articulating or demonstrating that actually there's quite a lot of judgment in there in understanding the specific facts and circumstances and really drilling down into what's actually going on here.
Touching again, Mary.
No, I am, because I misspoke before and I want to fix a screw-up on my part, which is 95, of course, is cost to fulfill a contract, so it is relevant when you have a performance obligation.
Brian?
So I wanted to come back on the scope and on reimbursement. On scope, you know, I can see that there would clearly be a general benefit to everyone to have a definitive answer on the scope question. On the other hand, just as a behavioural matter, I would be inclined to push scope to a conclusion in a case where it mattered to the accounting, because it would focus everyone's mind, would focus my mind a bit more. On the reimbursement, I just want to come back on this difference between conditional and unconditional and where in the analysis I think that fits. So in the kind of contracts we have in my business, an audit firm, a professional services firm, we might sometimes have some expenses that will be specifically chargeable to a client. They'll be reimbursable, and maybe there will be a complete pass-through. And there will be a complete pass-through where we are just buying something for the client. So we are the agent. We are the agent for that particular cost category. So it's never our cost, so we incur the cost, debit, contract, asset, or receivable. Here we're talking about training costs, and I don't feel that I can be an agent when training my own workforce. And that's why I think the cost accounting for the training costs is separate for the question as to whether or not there's a receivable. And the conditionality, as I say, tells me whether or not I have a receivable. Whether or not I have a cost at some point in the process is really an agent principle question. And I think I'm a principal for training my own people.
Okay.
To answer your question, Sue, I think what probably those capitalizing cost to fulfill a contract in those circumstances, they will feel frustrated by the answer. And what I understood is that effectively one of the main reasons is that they think the criteria of paragraph 95 within IFRS 15 are fulfilled. And the only reason why they can't account for as an asset for a cost to fulfill a contract is because you need to refer to IAS 38, which states that by nature those costs can't be capitalized. But the capitalization there is within IAS 38. It's for internal cost generated, and it's not for internal cost generated within a contract with a customer. So the point is there. The problem is that effectively, mechanically, almost mechanically, we need to answer that because those training costs are mentioned in IAS 38 as being necessarily an expense, because they can't be capitalized within IAS 38, which can be totally irrelevant because you can't control your workforce, hence you can't control the value, the incremental value attributed to the training costs for your staff, which totally makes sense within the boundaries of IAS 38. But there is a question which is an extra one, which is not just within the boundaries of IAS 38, which is also we add something within IFRS 15. And there is a contract with a customer. And those costs will benefit not only internally to the entity and its staff, but also to the contract with the customer. And so there is a kind of mechanical answer saying that those costs, they can't be an asset being cost to fulfill a contract. They are cost to fulfill a contract, but they won't be treated as an asset. It's where there is a tension. Even though I understand the analysis and I agree with the analysis and the answer of the staff, at the same time, I just it strikes me a lot that effectively, just because there is a rule, I said the paragraph 67, it's 67 and 69, and the rule is expressed in 69. Just because there is a rule in 69 that applies to internal costs of an entity, you then derive this answer to a case whereby you have a contract with a customer, and those can't be an asset within cost to fulfill a contract, which is, we're not exactly in the same case as the reason why those costs are expenses incurred in IAS 38.
Can I take you back to the question again, though, and away from what you'd like the answer to?
So the only solution, I mean, it's not, the problem is really not in IAS, in IFRS 15, for sure. But if there is a problem to solve, it's in IAS 38.
But you did acknowledge and you agree with the analysis. Because you do acknowledge the interaction between 15 and 38, even if you don't like the effect of that?
I like the interaction between IAS 38 and IFRS 15 more generally. I have no problem with that. But obviously the two are intrinsically related, and for sure, what I said previously in previous meetings relating to IAS 38 is that IAS 38 is not maybe at the level of IFRS 15, so we should probably enhance IAS 38 to put it at the same level as IFRS 15. But yeah, there is an interaction between the two, and because of this interaction, that's the main reason why I understand the analysis and the answer of the staff. At the same time, I think the training costs mentioned in the submission are not exactly the one that are mentioned in paragraph 69 of IAS 38, because those ones are really the training costs of the internal training costs of the entity, and I totally understand within the boundaries of current IAS 38, yep. There is no way of capitalizing that internally. That's not a problem. The problem is really then when you interact that with a contract with a customer, and why can't those costs be a cost to fulfill a contract?
Okay. All right. So at some point I'm going to see how many people agree with the interaction between these scope paragraphs, and maybe one way to make that question easier would be if we could do what Guy suggested much earlier in this conversation, which was somehow to make a statement that the nature of the training costs being internal for the entity, etc., means it's within 38, to try and take some of that judgment at least off to focus on the scope question. Lisa, scope questions? On the scope question,
I do agree that the guidance that is in IFRS 15, and especially if you read the basis of conclusion and what the board was thinking at the time about not taking on a project to go and look at all these other costs, that that's very clear that they were saying you would go to the actual standard where it's referred to and apply the guidance there. What I'm challenging is more than maybe the second bit is, well, is that really the correct answer, and maybe, you know,
just reading the words.
Yeah, no, not just reading the words. Is that really the right place we need to be? And this kind of goes maybe just to challenging when the board decided at the time that it, from the basic conclusion that I guess to go in and look at all that, it probably would have taken too much time. So is this something that there's certain things that they should be looked at? But I just go back to the fact of, you know, if it's a cost that is completely direct and incremental and only related to fulfilling the performance obligation under the contract, then I feel that you should look to the criteria within IFRS 15 and 95 to 98 and assessing whether or not you should actually capitalize that. And my concern is, especially that we're talking about training costs because this was the actual example, but it goes to what Bob said. I mean, there's so many ways you could structure around that. I could hire an advisor to manage a contract, this particular contract for me, and that would be someone hired specifically to work on that contract and providing that service. But they could come in, and their responsibility, one of them, is to actually train my employees for whatever is required to perform under that contract. And if that, under that particular scenario, I think I would be able to capitalize those costs. So there's probably some different, maybe there's different ways you could find, you know, to get around this, and that's why I guess I'm challenging that if it's something that you have a cost, which is how a lot of people would analyze it, even in looking at it today, is that if you went to 38 and it says you're an IFRS 15, and they're looking at a contract that we have a performance obligation with IFRS 15, then automatically I think a lot of people would interpret that you would go through the analysis under the cost to fulfill, and you would analyze it there. So there could be inconsistency in practice today.
Carsten?
I just wanted to emphasize that paragraph 95 of IFRS 15 says you look at other standards first, which is what the staff has done, right? So you look at IS 38, whether you can capitalize as an asset under IS 38. I think the answer is no. I just wanted to emphasize paragraph 95 just says you look at other standards. So I think that means you need to look is there any other standard that may allow capitalization? And that brings me to IFRS 9. So if you have an unconditional right to reimbursement, then I think IFRS 9 would tell you it's a receivable. And I think that it might be worth mentioning. That's
okay. That's fair. But you'd need to have completed the performance obligation. Yeah. It's a question. Yeah. You couldn't have any outstanding performance obligations to get
I think that's a separate question. I mean, I think you have to make that assessment whether or not you have an unconditional right to recharge and get the consideration from the customer.
But Carsten's right. The paragraph doesn't say check of 38 applies. It says check of another standard applies.
Yeah. But I do see that as distinct to the...
I suppose
to the accounting for the cost and whether that creates an asset and a resource.
Yeah.
So I'm very much thinking what Brian said earlier on.
I was going to say, like Brian described, it's like the question we've got on the table is when I actually incur the cost, pay cash for the training. You know, what do I do with the debit? And I think that's a real question, but it's a second question about the reimbursement and whether that gives rise to a receivable or not.
Young Sue?
As for the scoping question, I think paragraph 28 is important. Actually, that is the paragraph of BC 307. The BC is explaining us the intention of the board. And what the board says in the BC is that, you know, they are recognizing the interaction between 38 and 15, but as for the assetizing or the capitalizing, they are certain about it. If one standard says no, the other standard should say also no, which is the consistencies between the standards. So I think, in general, there should be some kind of circularity problems between 38 and 15, but at least for assetizing the asset and assetizing something, there is no circularity problem because of the sentence. I just want to mention just one more thing. You know, I just read paragraph 95 of IFRS 15, 95B. And what it says is that only the cost that can generate or enhance resources of the entity, quote unquote, of the entity, I think is very important. And what they mean is that no matter what cost is spent, the cost should generate or enhance resources that belongs to the entity. Training cost does not belong to the entity, I think. Training cost belongs to the employees, and employees can leave the entity anytime employees want to. So we cannot advertise something that does not belong to the entity. So I fully support the analysis and conclusion of the staff.
Thank you, Nelson. Michael.
Just a couple of observations. On the scope, I agree with staff analysis. I guess one thing that might be useful to clarify, and it might be outside the scope of the agenda decision, I think, but there's been a lot of discussion about the conditionality, unconditionality. I'm a little confused by it, because I think I can see in Brian's case, if you're an agent, then it is credit, cash, debit, receivable. It's a pass-through. But where we've established that the costs are in 38, and so you've got an expense, when we talk about a receivable, what's the credit for that receivable when we've established also that there's not a performance obligation? So is it revenue or is it something else? So I don't know if that is something we need to clarify or if we... I don't think in the agenda decision, but I'm just not sure about where the discussion is about the...
So if it's helpful, so I don't know if it's a test for new members that they have to do double entry at their first meeting. But it seems to me that the question is, have you transferred something to the customer? Because if you had, it would be credit, revenue, debit, contract, asset. I think the assumption is you haven't transferred anything to the customer. Have you incurred a cost? Well, you have incurred a cost, assuming it's not eligible for capitalisation. The entry is credit, cash, debit, P&L, debit and expense in P&L. If you have an unconditional right, a right to receive cash that's conditional only on the passage of time, it's debit receivable. And if you've recognised a receivable in advance of transferring anything to a customer, the credit is a contract liability, I think.
The point is that that if you're not the agent, the recharge is in the transaction price.
Yeah.
It's an embedded part of the revenue
exactly.
contract.
That's fine. And if that's all clear, then that's fine.
So the conditional unconditionality is really affecting when you recognise that receivable.
So it's just a balance sheet gross up.
Yeah.
So clear, it took the Interpretation Committee 45 minutes to get there, but...
Mikhail?
Yes, I'm coming back to what I started to say. I think the company that is in this situation, a service provider of some kind, and look at this new customer, and we have time running with different reporting dates. Of course, they want to have a matching of their revenue and expenses. That is, I think, the general thinking from most of the people. And looking at this then, I understand, and I think that is the problem, so to speak, that yes, the training cost will not then in IAS 38 be defined as an asset. But in the fact pattern, it is clearly said that you can recharge these costs in beginning of the contract. So we have not in this fact pattern needed to provide any services. We can then charge this to the customer. So if you look on the fact pattern, we, I think, need to answer that question. In this fact pattern, should you have an asset, whatever kind of asset, or should it be expense? Because that is the question. Then you can say there's two questions then with the arguments or the definition of a training cost, if that can be different depending on if it's inside the contract or general for the company and so on. But the fact pattern includes that you can resource this cost. So I think that must be part of the analyse and we responded to.
Mikhail, sorry, I didn't cover myself in glory last time I intervened, so I'm trying to be cautious. But I thought that the fact pattern was, you know, with respect to billing, it just said that you had the right to recover the costs on the initial group of employees,
yes.
It was not specific about whether you had an unconditional right to recharge the day you incurred the cost, or, you know, it's possible that I think the fact pattern that was submitted wasn't clear whether it was an unconditional right or whether you also had to do something else before you could bill those costs. Mm-hmm. It just was saying that the only costs that would qualify are for your initial group of employees. So I think that's a slight distinction from the fact pattern you were describing.
That is not what it says in the description on the 5C.
I mean, maybe we need to clarify the words then, because I think it is very much what Mary said. So it's about the employees that are employed at the beginning of the contract. So we can have a look at the wording to make that clear.
Paragraph C on page 11.
Yeah.
It says permits to recharge the cost of training those at the beginning of the contract.
Yeah.
It's the employees at the beginning of the contract. It's not the recharge at the beginning of the contract.
Yeah.
Is how I read C.
Yeah. Yeah. Jake?
I thought about this a lot, and I think the thing that doesn't come out from that fact pattern is I think it would be highly unlikely that you'd ever have a contract like this where you have an unconditional right to get those costs back if, for example, you didn't then go on and provide those services. So it isn't the provision of training that gives you the right to income. It is actually then the provision of services thereafter. So the idea that you would have that unconditional right immediately, I think, is highly unlikely.
Fair. All right.
Sorry.
I'll ask you question 2, which is on page 10 of the paper, which is whether the committee agrees with the staff's recommendation not to add the matter to its standard setting agenda. I'll get a show of hands, please.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
Okay. And then Trina/Henry, can I hand over to you for anything you've heard that you would suggest that we would amend in the tentative agenda decision before I ask the committee about it? I wondered whether there was something we could do to make it clear that it was a training cost that was, you know,
specifically acknowledged by 38.
Determined, yeah, that prima facie 38 applies.
I think that would be very helpful.
But it needs to be carefully worded not to sort of answer the scope question before you get into the scope answer.
Yeah, that was my nervousness, but we can, you know, we can try and do something there.
We could say it's a training cost as described in paragraph whatever of 38. So rather than saying that 38 applies, but
as described, yeah, in paragraph 15 of IS 38.
Yeah. That would be one way of addressing it. And then any other changes before I ask the committee members for their thoughts on the draft agenda decision?
Not based on our analysis.
Okay. Right.
What the change is.
Does anybody have any other comments on the wordings before I ask for a vote, taking into account the suggestion that we just had, Jake?
It's only listening to the discussion this morning, I was wondering the relevance of the final sentence of subparagraph C in the fact. I don't think that has been a fundamental input into the discussion that's been had here, and I wonder whether it just potentially confuses matters.
Yeah, take it out.
So you suggest we delete the second sentence in little C on page 11. Confusing rather than clarifying.
Yeah. Yeah. So can I ask a question? Are we talking about just at the beginning, the fact pattern, point C?
We're going to talk about the whole agenda decision, but at the moment, yes, we're talking about little C on page 11.
Yeah. So just for clarity, Jake's suggestion is that on page 11, in the tentative agenda decision, description of the fact pattern, bullet C, the second sentence, I think he's saying, and at least that sounds sensible to me, to say that sentence is not particularly relevant to the conclusion, so therefore if we remove that sentence, it probably creates greater clarity.
I actually think it is relevant because it clarifies the cost you're talking about, because we're talking about the cost that could be recharged, whether or not that is something that can be capitalized, and what standard do you look at?
I think it's quite important to keep all the facts into the paper and the decision, and also for the comments that people will have to fully understand that.
Because in my mind, it's the first part of the cost that we're talking about, not the second, but I think it's important to clarify which piece we're talking about.
My reason for raising that, just in responding to that, is if I read that and I was being challenging, I'd read that final sentence in paragraph C and say, OK, does that change whether or not I can recognise an asset for those costs?
I'm not sure that it did based on the discussion, which is why I thought maybe it was helpful.
It might not change the decision where you get to, but it might actually help that someone can get comfortable with the fact of going, OK, I'm paying this whole control aspect about the employees. I think it might help in that respect. But that I don't really... If they leave, then that means I can't recharge it again. So,
but I think it's that... I think why the sentence is important, but also why there may be differences of opinion about how much it matters for it to be in here or not, is that I thought that the analysis was that even if you were able to recharge the costs, it wouldn't change Brian's journal entry, which was debit expense, credit cash, for these costs. It might affect the question of whether you then had the debit receivable credit contract liability journal entry, but not the second journal entry, which is the one that this agenda decision is about, which is why I thought deleting that sentence might actually be helpful. Can I get a show of hands on the tentative agenda decision with the addition of a reference to the fact that the training costs are
as described in
paragraph 15 of IS 38 and the deletion of the second sentence in paragraph C. Can I get a show of hands on that?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Okay. So that will go out for comment. Thank you. All right. That felt like hard work already.